Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 215, Buddhism and Shamanism.
Okay, how are you all? Today is it's an auspicious day. Actually, I feel sad. There was a terrible hurricane, and some parts of the Bahamas got really, really blasted. And now the Hurricane Dorian is heading up the coast. So I'm sad about that, but it's auspicious because I'm thinking about the miraculous in the context of Buddhist yoga. And it may turn out, it's being investigated by the wonderful Singleton and Mallinson team, and it may turn out that all yoga is Buddhist anyway, in spite of even what the Indians kind of forgot about. Might turn out to be that that's what we think of as yoga nowadays could be very much something, another gift of the Buddha to India, rather than something coming out of the old conquering Vedic people who settled down in northern India. A few weeks I'm giving a teaching with my friend Isa at Menla, which we've done before, called Shamans and Siddhas. And, you know, the sort of duality between, now there is in some cultures, there is a really serious duality. And it has to do with the fact that in some forms of shamanism, animal sacrifice is part of the rituals that the shamans use. And Buddha never wanted animal sacrifice. Even though he allowed Buddhist monks to accept meat food, if they get it from a house where that's where they're eating that, and that how they didn't know that that house was eating meat, and it's just whatever they're given. And even they're not allowed to refuse, unless they are a strict vegetarian or they have a health reason. And this was a point of contention between Buddhism and Jainism in the old days, but it was just typical Buddhist pragmatism. If someone was about to cook a meal and we're going to slaughter a chicken or something to make chicken soup, then the Buddhist monk has to leave and say, no, thank you. So then that, if you extrapolate that into the modern situation where you have the mass market, and then if you go to a market and buy meat, in a way you are asking it for yourself very indirectly. But on the other hand, of course, if you do, they're not going to, like, you know, give away all their cows or liberate them to be back in the plains from the meat industry. But on the other hand, if you can create a movement and a whole huge horde of people go vegan and vegetarian, then you really saved some lives of some cows, and you have diminished the meat industry, which is going to be necessary on this planet and will happen inevitably, and it will be, some people will take the lead in that. There's a wonderful book by Jeremy Rifkin called Beyond Beef that is wonderful in its analysis of the harmful effects of meat industries all over the world. But he never discusses or mentions or studies, and he's a great scholar, so he should have studied. He would say a lot about it, that India moved to vegetarianism kind of naturally. You know, they, from these Buddhism, and then Hinduism took over from Buddhism and Jainism, the notion of ahimsa, and then they have the sacred cow for the Hindus and so on. And so Buddhism sort of naturally, economically moved to vegetarianism without having read Jeremy Rifkin's book or dealing with the horrible mass factory meat production, which is so atrocious and so inhumane and so horrible, really. So anyway, the Siddhas were not necessarily vegetarian, all of them, but nevertheless, the idea of making holy meat and killing as if it were doing something for your ancestors or for your sickness, use scapegoat type of rituals, Buddha completely was not in favor of that. And therefore, when Buddhism encountered Tibetan shamanism, Mongolian shamanism, in other cultures, Southeast Asian shamanism and so forth, Indian shamanism for that matter, Buddha insisted on not what they call blood sacrifice. And actually they influenced, therefore, those traditions very dramatically because of that. On the other hand, the Buddha was a kind of shaman himself. And he did go up a tree. He was born under a tree. When his mother leaned on one, he was enlightened. He reached his final enlightenment under a tree. And the tree of enlightenment is a major symbol in Buddhism. Because like the tree of the nervous system, the tree of enlightenment, the tree as the bridge between heaven and earth, you know, all the archaic techniques of ecstasy, all the old methods of the shaman, traveling to the heavens to meet the ancestors, traveling to underworld, the roots of the tree going to underworld. Tree is a big deal, you know, for shamans. And he passed away under two trees, the Buddha did. And so he was a master of all three worlds, what it's called. There are three ways of designating three worlds as underworld, surface of earth, and heavens. And another way is the desire realm, the realm of pure form or subtle form, subtle matter, and then the realm of the non-material realm, the realm of relative disembodiment. So therefore, there's a natural affinity between Buddha and the shamans. It started popping in my mind is the story about when Naropa visited Tilopa at first. He met him by the side of a river where Tilopa was just finishing a fish dinner. And then Naropa was outraged because he was as well as a Buddhist monk, or previously had been a Buddhist monk, he had resigned to go seek a Siddha teacher and do Tantra, advanced level Tantra. But then he met him in the forest, and I'll tell that story more later. But when he met him, he was eating fish, and then he was kind of horrified. He said, "Well, how can you be a yogi and a pure person and eat fish?" "What fish?" said Tilopa, and the fish skeletons on his plate re-enfleshed themselves and jumped off the plate into the river and swam off. That's the topic of the miraculous. You know? And we only call it miraculous because we are brought up in this materialist culture where mind, you know, is not supposed to rule over matter unless you're a woo-woo sort of person. And therefore, we don't think that Uri Geller bent spoons really, you know, even though it was reaffirmed in the Matrix movie. And we ourselves don't think we really have minds. Did I ever tell you the story when I was meditating late at night when I was a Buddhist monk? And my own Mongolian teacher, who was definitely a Siddha, showed up in his usual way of always interrupting me meditating. It was one of the favorite things he had. And he knew every minute, when he knew every time I was meditating, particularly, he always would show up when I was going into like some kind of disembodied state. I was leaving the body. I was feeling that detached from it or something. Going a little bit experimenting with formless states, a little tiny taste. I'm not really at it. But whenever I would get close to it even, bam, he would show up, interrupt me. And this one time was late at night. I was deeply meditating. I had been studying for maybe 2-3 years. I was really concentrating. He shows up and turns on the light in this chapel. I had a little candle. And in the chapel at the monastery we built together in New Jersey. And what are you doing? He says. And then I go, "What do you mean, what am I doing? I'm meditating." "Well, why are you meditating?" what's the point? I said, what do you mean, why am I meditating? I'm a Buddhist monk. I'm a student. I want to become enlightened. You have to meditate as well as learn. He said, yeah, but you can't get enlightened. I said, why not? He says, you're an American. I said, what? Yeah, I'm born in New York, but I'm a Buddhist monk, and I'm complaining. I knew he was referring to disbelief in former and future life as a cultural thing in the West. And but I said, I do believe in that. I'm fully involved in that. I think it's very normal. You know, I was trying to complain. He says, no. He says, maybe you do in one way, but he says, in another way, what gets enlightened is your mind. And you Americans think you don't have one, he said. So then I exploded in protest and was completely distracted. And we went off and had a big debate over some yogurt at 3 a.m. in the monastery kitchen, which was his purpose, of course, to rattle me. But in a way, and I argued with him for weeks over that one, but a long time later I realized, of course, he's right. We don't think there's sort of somehow, we don't identify with really what is deeper in our being, which is a feeling of something that is not quite coarse material, although, of course, we decide to move our hands, so somehow it interrelates with what we think of as coarse material, you know, limbs and muscles and sensations and feelings. But it's somehow a register, it's a place that's kind of more vague, more subtle. You know, some people philosophically would say it's non-material. But some people would say it is subtle matter. I would say, you know, tantric science, tantric Abhidharma, would call it subtle material, super subtle, subtle and super subtle. The mind, in other words, and therefore we don't have a kind of faith that if we really put our mind to something material, even we would affect it with our mind. We know that we sort of will do it. You know, if we're wishing for something, something like that, we'll do that. But we kind of start out defeated ahead of time because we think, well, I wish it's just mental and it can't really cause a physical effect. And if we ever did see a mental thing seeming to cause a physical effect, we would think that was a miracle. But in some other cultures, more enlightened cultures, that's not really the case. And in fact, they think that such things are normal. And therefore, for example, I never use the term supernatural about miraculous things. I only use supernormal in our cultural context, because in the cultural context of India and some of the other Buddhist Asian countries and Hindu and Taoist ones, there are supernormal things that happen. So the siddhas. So the shaman in a society, I mean, I'm not Isa, but I would say the role of the shaman, and by the way, the word shaman, I've heard that Mircea Eliade's a famous book called Archaic Techniques of Ecstasy, Shamanism, Archaic Techniques of Ecstasy, has been, you know, criticized in some way, like his book on yoga was. But I still like the book. You know, maybe there's some fine points, you know, whatever, that, because it's been updated. But I really like the idea, and his idea is that the shaman may come, the word may come from shramana. Shramana is a term applied to Buddha during the time of his quest for enlightenment, and then afterwards when he lived as a homeless monk, or mendicant rather. Monk connotes the Christian thing, but really mendicant is better. And shramana means one who wanders or who seeks, and it has a connotation of being seeking a rest from the weariness of the world. And therefore it connects to the word ashram, which means where you go to rest, you know, on retreat, or, you know, withdraw from mundane activities, you know. And a shramana then is one who withdraws from their mundane social roles and seeks truth, to seek enlightenment, to seek to understand the nature of reality. If they're theists, they might want to seek the oneness with God or whatever it is. That's a shramana. And many of the Indian shramanas wandered up into the Himalayas and over the Himalayas and into Central Asia. And so the word then may have been picked up and then, you know, used or became sort of used in Central Asia and eventually in Siberia, where they where some people, more modern anthropologists, think the word shaman came from through Russian, maybe. Russian itself, by the way, is very connected to Sanskrit. Very, very, its grammar and everything has a lot of relationship, and vocabulary has relation to Sanskrit. So there's sort of an Indo-Russo-Siberian belt that may be there. And then when they do that, they connect to sort of the powers of nature, and they become healers in their society and leaders and psychologists, psychiatrists, for people who get nervous or who don't function well in whatever community they live in, and teachers. And they often pair up with the sort of the chief, you know, who deals with sort of mundane production matters and defense matters, king, later the kings. And so that is the nature of the shaman. And Buddha certainly was, that's what he was. Of course, he was originally born in the king class, but he betrayed that class. He abandoned it. He didn't think it was that important a class, although it was the boss class in his time. And he decided he would find the true nature of reality and help people with their true problems, which a shaman does. And the true problems of a being, of course, are suffering of birth, suffering of aging, suffering of sickness, suffering of death, and then lots of other interpersonal and other kinds of issues. And he wanted to, you know, suffering of not knowing what life is for, wasting life, wasting one's own life, all of these things. So in that sense, shamans and Buddha and Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are very similar. And then among the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, there's a kind of Buddha that Shakyamuni Buddha definitely himself was, we definitely think. And then a number of his mendicant disciples also became that. And although they kind of kept from the public in India for centuries even, the levels of preaching and practice that they were engaged in. And for 400 years or so, 400 or 500 years, the mendicant mode was the main profession of the Buddhist seeker. For the next 400 or 500, added to that, that was continued, but added to that was the Bodhisattva mode, which that might mean you wouldn't be a mendicant, you'd remain a lay person, or you'd be mendicant and then again a lay person, although, or both. And then finally you have the esoteric people, the Tantricas, in the next 500 years, last 500 years of this period of India before it became conquered by external people, who had their own ideologies and didn't conform to the Indian way of life around 1,000 years ago. So those 1,500 to 1,800 years when the Buddhist energy was there, they were really basically shamans, but the most the siddhas, which means the one who has achieved, the old translation of it by the European scholars, they called it Zauberer, which means a sorcerer. But they, you know, it has a negative connotation, the word sorcerer, but magical indeed they were, like shamans are, and they dealt with the miraculous indeed. Modern people say, well, that's silly, and that we know that's not possible because we're materialists, but that's there. It's also there in Christian mysticism, Sufi mysticism, the great yogis, let's call them, of that, those traditions, miraculous things happen around them for sure. Like St. Francis, you know, hanging out with vicious animals, the wolves, people having visions. My father translated a book called The Little Flowers, Les Petites Fleurs, written, I think, by François Mauriac, which was a life of Francis of Assisi. And he uses from ancient chronicles the idea that sometimes when Francis would have a kind of festival or people would have teaching or some holidays, feast time, people would come on retreat with him, they would see visions in the sky of Jesus and the angels and the saints and things collectively, which should be miraculous, and which is commonplace in the Buddhist world, actually, as well. So, and these are all disbelieved, of course, and called hagiographic. They have a word, hagiographic. Somebody makes a life of a saint or a famous person and adds miracles to it later, and then that's called hagiography. But that's only based on the fact that we think that materialism is the only real reality. And that's only based on the fact that we haven't yet incorporated the insights of quantum physics and relativity fully, where we realize we don't know what material reality is, actually. And there may be playing a role in which subtle energies have a play, and they may even have a controlling and a formative play if someone knows how consciously to exist on the levels of the subtle energies. And at least that's certainly the goal of what are called tantric sciences and tantric arts, tantric practices, is to mobilize self-conscious awareness on the super subtle and subtle levels, not just on the coarse body level, although not neglecting the coarse body, of course, but not just on that level. So therefore, I've enjoyed working with Isa on these shamans and siddhas things, and we always do enjoy, have a great time with the people when we come. And of course, her tradition is a tradition where there is not, they don't do animal sacrifice, of course. And that would be the way, I think, right now, for example, where Buddhism is being rekindled after communism, like in Mongolia, there's a little bit of a struggle between shamans and siddhas. Lamas and shamans, you know, they're like, because they're thinking, there is a little bit of a movement to return to the old blood shamanism, tribal shamanism, and, because of them having been wasted by invasions and things. And then the Buddhists are really upset about that. But I think the best resolution of those struggles is not to denigrate or deprecate shamanism, but is to move toward a, sublimated shamanism, where you are going to the thing and you're doing that and you're not making blood sacrifices. The most marvelous ritual the Tibetans have. Some of our own people wrongly think Tibetans mixed shamanism and Buddhism, and that made it a lower form, what they call Lamaism, was a lower form of Buddhism, but that's really mistaken. The Tibetans did what I'm talking about, really, in a way, which is they revitalized, it transformed shamanism by encouraging, let's say, the shamans to learn another kind of shamanism and not, not kill animals, in other words, but go through the, and the summit of that practice was this marvelous teaching by a Tibetan woman, which it was one of the few Tibetan teachings in the ancient period that fed back into India and was considered a great teaching in India, which otherwise mostly the transmission was from India to Tibet, which is the ritual known as Jö, which I translate and others do also as severance.
Aloha and greetings to you, podcast wallas. This is podcast producer Justin Stone Diaz, and I'd like to welcome you to this week's episode of the Bob Thurman Podcast. This episode of the Bob Thurman Podcast was originally recorded September 2019 at the home of Robert and Nena Thurman in Woodstock, New York, and was originally live streamed on Facebook September 2019. To watch the full extended video version of this podcast, please look in the podcast description or visit Professor Thurman's Facebook page. He can be found by searching for Robert A.F. Thurman or Bob Thurman on your favorite social media platforms. And to learn about the upcoming Shamans and Siddhas retreat that he mentions in the first half of this week's episode, please look in the podcast description or visit Bob's website at bobthurman.com. Information can also be found on the Tibet House US website and the Menla Retreat website at tibethouse.us and menla.us respectively. The Bob Thurman Podcast is brought to you in part through the generous support of the Tibet House US membership community and listeners like you. To learn more about the benefits of Tibet House membership, including special invites to Dasa tours around the world with Professor Thurman, led by geographic expeditions, please visit tibethouse.us. Your monthly support helps make Tibet House's mission of presenting and preserving Tibetan culture possible. Your membership also entitles you to discounts on programs held in New York City and upstate at Menla Retreat and Dewa Spa in Phoenicia, New York. Trips in 2019 include Bhutan. Music for the Bob Thurman podcast is generously supplied by our dear friend Tenzing Chogyal. To learn more about the music and work of Tenzing Chogyal, please visit his website at tenzingchogyal.com. And now, back to the second half of this week's episode, which includes Professor Thurman explaining the practice of Chod. And stay tuned as Gary Gok reads poetry after Bob concludes this week's episode. Tasha Dalek, and thanks for listening.
Which I translate and others do also as severance. And what that is where you meditate, you go to usually a kind of eerie, sublime, ominous place where demons might gather, or ghosts, or ghouls, or goblins, and things like that, like cemetery or such place. And you meditate there, and you chant, and you invite all the unsatisfied, ghostly, demonic beings, because anybody who is a ghost or a demon or a goblin or anything like that, they have that form because of frustration, because of greed. It's a lower form than the human form, and is more regressing toward more subsistent levels of life than the human or the divine. And so, but you invite them all to come and feed on you. It's marvelous, really. And you visualize that your own intelligence in the form of a goddess, of a Dakini, of a kind of witch almost, like, comes, a divine one and benevolent one, but comes anyway and chops you up in a little piece, takes slices off your skull and puts it in a bowl, puts it in a tripod, and then slices up and chops up all your flesh and blood and bones. In doing so, cooks you then with the fire of your own wisdom. And then you make a delicious nectar ambrosia soup that you feed all these demons with. And then you imagine that you merge with clear light, you transcend death, and you re-embody yourself in a more divine way, but then you're ready again to give yourself away. There's a story. I'm going to be reading some stories in the next podcast. See, I'll do a series. I was encouraged by my friends to do something on what I call the poetry of enlightenment. And among the greatest poems, of course, in the Buddhist world are the poems of Milarepa, and the great Saint Milarepa. And I'm going to do his poems, some of them. And there's one that I will do maybe in more length, but I'll just tell the story now. It's a marvelous story where he's meditating up near Mount Everest on the high slopes there, Dingri, I think, if we're known in Tibetan, that area, or near there. And he's in winter, too, because he has this inner heat where he's always hot, so he doesn't mind being naked in winter, in the Tibetan winter, which is really an intense one, high altitude. And these five goddesses come to him, who are the goddesses of the mountains, as it turns out. But at first, he doesn't know who they are. He thinks they're some kind of ogress, because they come in very ferocious forms. And they say, oh, we have a nice juicy looking yogi here. Well, you're a little skinny, but you know, we can barbecue, you'll be delicious. And we're gonna waste you, you know, you're on our mountain. You didn't ask, et cetera, et cetera. And he says, don't you dare. I'm the fierce Buddha, He Vajra. I'm an archetype Buddha of great power and ferocity. And, you know, I'll blow you away, you know, like, and then he sprouted all many arms like He Vajra and many heads and faces. And they said, oh, yummy, more arms and limbs. And now you're fatter as that form you're adopting, and we can barbecue all of the arms, and all of it, we'll have divine barbecue even, and it's really great. You don't think we could scare us by being like some fierce Buddha or something, an archetype. So then he quickly retreated from that approach of trying to over and dominate them, and said, oh, okay, I apologize, I didn't get really how amazing you are. So now let me offer you, invite you to a feast. And then he practiced a kind of Jew ritual where he literally dismembered himself and he cooked himself, and at least in visionary, you can't really tell in the text whether it's visionary or literal, but he sort of basically was willing to feed them from himself, give his own body to them to eat, which of course bodhisattvas do that. And tantric ones do it hundreds of times, you know, because when bodhisattvas do it in an exoteric sense, they die and they become reborn again. It's a long, slow process. But tantrikas, they do that and then they pull themselves back together out of subtle energy because they're self-conscious on the subtle level. So they can shape flesh, level of flesh and blood and bone. They can shape that from the level of pure, non-atomic, super subtle energy. So then they turn into beautiful five goddesses, the goddess Jomo Longma, I think Jomo Longma, something that's Mount Everest, and or all these other great mountains, you know, K2, they're all goddesses, you know, and they turn really beautiful. And since he's a layman and a yogi, they get it on with him, you know, they have a great party, a feast. And of course, they don't devour him, you know, at all, but it's the willingness to give himself that was what moved their mind to love, you know, when they realized he was a genuine person rather than he's just some sort of macho yogi who's going to scare them or something. That they laughed when he did that. It's a marvelous, and his 100,000 song is song number 28, that particular one. It's really nice. Somebody did a whole thesis on it that I thought was quite fun. I forget the name of the author. So, the scholar who did that. So the Mahasiddhas. Now, this relates very much to the concept of crazy wisdom, which we hear much about because of scandals coming from different lamas. I think the Zen people sort of adopted some of it because they had some scandals with some of their roshis. And the people who are defending the lamas and the roshis, you know, say that, well, they're doing crazy wisdom and they're helping us, really. And maybe they've done what it seemed like what they were doing seemed unethical in terms of sex and power and money. But maybe they were helping us overcome our ego or our detachment. It was, they use that as an excuse. And this is, you know, there's a middle way in interpreting that. It's not 100% wrong in all cases, but it's mostly wrong in most cases. And it's a misunderstanding of something that is called crazy wisdom. There's a crazy kind of stage of a yogi, a crazy conduct that yogis get into, and advanced Zen people, I think, too, where they sort of give themselves to the universe. And like there was one famous Korean guy whose centennial was celebrated. I went to Korea for that, 1913. And he was known for his rigorous asceticism, where he was in some place where they had a lot of dreadful blood-drinking bugs, mosquitoes or worse, something maybe worse, lychee-type mosquitoes. And he was spent a long time just all infested with these, where he had like a body of insects. They would just lived on him. And he meditated like that for years, and let them devour him, you know, in a certain way, drink his blood. But somehow he replenished it by eating or something, so that it became a long meditation. And so the idea of giving yourself is a big thing for the enlightened person. And that's crazy. You don't sit and let them bugs eat you, you know. You don't, in a way, crazy. Without Tantra, you know, the young prince Buddha in a previous life, famous one, where he was a prince on a royal picnic, and he and his brother went out of the woods, and they saw a tigress. It was a time of famine and drought in a country, and a tigress was starving to death along with her four cubs. And he noted that he looked down off the cliff top down into the lair, and he saw the tigress was about to devour her cubs out of hunger, because apparently in nature that can happen, where a mother will devour a batch of cubs in straitened circumstance, thinking to live, and then have a new batch later, you know, have a new batch of cubs later, even though normally that goes totally, of course, against even the tiger's maternal instinct, where she will fight for her cubs against any predators and so on. But he noticed that it was about to happen. So he, on a pretense, he sent his brother back to the camp to bring some burgers or some food, which they would give to the tiger, and the brother ran off through the woods. And then he himself jumped down off the cliff, made an offering of his flesh and blood to the tigress and her cubs. And so they ate him. You know, he gave himself to be eaten. And then, you know, then the parents were really upset. Everybody was very upset afterwards. But then he spoke to them in that particular story. He spoke to them from a certain heavenly plane and said, listen, don't worry, I was delighted to give my body. It gave me a quantum leap in my progress toward Buddhahood. And I didn't suffer at all, you know. It was like just wonderful. I really enjoyed, you know. So that's crazy wisdom too. But then just like him, that was this rare, rare case. Even where they tell the story in different Buddhist literary versions, they say, now don't go jumping off and feed the first tiger. Because you're a human being, and you know, you might do it on a fit of kind of passionate wish of self-transcendence or self-surrender, but you might not be fully really ready to go, and then you deeply regret it, like, oh no, you know, when they take the first bite, and then you wriggle and try to run away, and it no longer really even becomes a gift. So you need to use your human intelligence to develop the amazing evolutionary progress you can make as a human being in your human life. And don't just do this in a sentimental way, just sort of too fast. So they actually say, have a caveat like that. And so therefore, this is my sort of middle way about crazy wisdom. There is such a thing, of course. But if everybody jumped into the tiger's lairs every day, that would not be crazy wisdom. That would be just crazy. It'd be stupid. And similarly, if some lama has to, like, make it with everybody and grab their bodies, you know, and do stuff to them and have them do stuff to the lama and do it all the time to everybody. That is crazy, not crazy wisdom. There might be a particular case of some particular one who's a layman and it's a yogin and a partner is well-trained and a consort, you know, in consort yoga, and herself at the same stage in terms of subtle body and you know, inner energy control and so on, where the two can do a kind of super athletic, not normally sexual type of yoga of developing inner ecstasies of different types to reach different stages of awareness. That's entirely possible, but that's really rare. And it's impossible to do it with a partner who's just grabbing kind of off the street, who wouldn't know who would just be thinking it was a case of regular sexuality, maybe secretly and worriedly thinking it was a case of rape, and you're some stupid lama demanding that you make it with everybody, or maybe, you know, whatever it would be, whatever fantasy they might have, it would be harmful to them in the long run. That's why these things always blow up, because it's not crazy wisdom, it's crazy. Harmful. You know, the precept, the third physical precept of the 10 precepts of the Buddhist is, and which is shared with all the traditions, is they usually translate as adultery, no adultery, but it isn't adultery. It means no abusive sexuality. Not to use, adultery is often abusive because it breaks up families, you know, causes social disruption. And so it's also often harmful to the people engaged in it. But that's not the only form of sexual abuse. So only positive sexuality, which is helpful to the partner, benevolent, and or some kind of spiritual practice is allowed in Buddhist ethics. I also used to use, when I was talking in the 70s and 80s about a certain lama who was very licentious and also alcohol addicted and terrible and a bad example in a way, I used to, when his disciples would defend him by saying it's crazy wisdom, it's real great for all of us and all this kind of thing, I rejected that, and I used to tell the story of the Zen guy, not just Tibetan, who the master had a student who'd been studying with him for years, if not decades. And we had a way, the master had developed a thing with him where when he came for the interview with the master, where you check your progress, Dokusan, the master, after some time or immediately even, would say something about emptiness or get out, and kind of push him out of the room. And so then this one time the guy really struggled to stay. And at that time, the master slammed the door on his leg and broke it. And he had the shock of the pain of a broken bone. And within the shock of that pain of the broken bone, because of the particular exact context of where he was in his progress in his mind, he had a very deep insight, which I consider to have been the way I would explain the insight, which I think is not rocket science. When he thought he had something to say about emptiness, might have been when he was headed for the demon ghost cave, where he was wrongly having an experience, or he was having a mistaken experience of what he thought might be emptiness, which might be a place outside the world, some kind of, you know, absolutized notion of a separated state. And so the harsh, bone-breaking brought him back into the reality of his body, which was where he needed to be. So in that sense, it was wise, it was a useful and benevolent teaching. But if that guy had broken the leg of everybody who ever visited him for practice on any level for years after years, he would not be considered a great Zen master. He would be arrested as a bone breaker, you know, some kind of weird fetish he had. Even in ancient times, they would have done something to him, punished him for that. Okay, so that's a little bit about sinners. Oh yeah, then I wanted to tell, then the famous story that is told by Western hippies and seekers, many of them great people. I'm not against hippies either. But anyway, they wanted to be like siddhas. They would have long hair, they'd do yoga, they might wrongly do some kind of too much sex and live, go to Nepal, you know, smoke a lot or whatever. And they always tell the story of how Naropa was a professor. I used to take it a little bit personally. He was a famous professor in Nalanda University. He was a door guardian, which was considered the top debater, like the equivalent of the chancellor or president of the university, provost, where it put at the doors in those universities, because you didn't keep your job there by having a contract with trustees. You kept your job by being the sharpest philosophically and pedagogically of anybody in the university. And so you would determine the curriculum of the university. So he was in that position, very high, like a dean, you know. And then this lady came, cleaning lady, and was sweeping there, and he was reading in his study, and she said to you, "Hey, Sunny, how you doing? I'm reading there." And he was talking to the cleaning lady, and said, "I'm fine. How are you?" And she said, "Fine." And then she said, "Well, do you understand that what you're reading, Sunny? Do you understand those words?" And he said, "Yeah, I understand." And she said, "Oh, good, good, good." And then she says, "Did you understand the meaning? Do you understand the meaning?" And he hesitated a minute and said, yeah, I got the meaning. And then she burst into tears, boo-hoo, and blubbering in his office there. And he's like, "What's the matter with you? Why are you crying?" She said, "Well, I'm crying because you're the dean of this university and you just told a lie because you do not know the meaning." And, "Oh, really? Well," he said, you know, she must have said it in some convincing way because he didn't just say, "Well, how do you know?" He just said, "Who does understand the meaning?" Kind of almost confessed it. And she said, "My brother does. my brother Tilopa. And he said, well, where is he? She says, well, he's out in the jungle somewhere. He said, can I go study with him? She said, yeah, sure you can. But you'll have to say 100,000 mantras of Om Sri Vajra He He Ruru Kam Hum Hum Pe Daka Nijala Sambaram Swaha, the mantra of the super bliss Buddha. Okay, fine. And he was so moved by her. And then she turned into rainbow light and flew out the window, the Kulin lady. So he realized it was a real message from the angels. You know? And then he did actually give up his professorship and he left the university. And he went off and he studied for a long time with Dilipa, and that's a long story. And he became the great Naropa, the great tantric siddha, adept, you know, which is how I like to translate siddha, mahasiddha, great adept. But then the story that they don't tell, that's also in the life of Naropa, is that he then, while studying with Dilipa, he took a vow not to go back and never do any academic debates. So he didn't go hang around with his old university. You know, he was off in the jungle and in meditation caves and death, you know, charnel grounds, things like that, auspicious places. But then one point, finally, the people sought him out from the monastery and desperately asked him to come back because some kind of a fundamentalist guy who just had a sort of magic trick about meditating came and defeated them all and was taking over the curriculum, and they were freaked out because they couldn't do the studies they wanted to do. So he did go back thinking to defend the university. But then when he got there, he couldn't speak. And so then the guy was ridiculing him. Oh, you came, you got your great Naropa, and he came and he was going to defeat me. And now he's like all choked up. He doesn't dare speak because I'm so cool. This yogi, this guy who was had the debate tricks, you know, that he could defeat anybody. And then Tilopa suddenly showed up. It was all very embarrassing, but then Tilopa showed up. And then Tilopa said to the guy who had corrupted the university, well, the reason he can't speak is because he took a vow to his guru never to debate. But now, Naropa, I give you a privilege to make one exception on that. So go ahead. So at that point, then Naropa suddenly opened his mouth. And instead of a formal argument, a giant lion's roar came out of his mouth, and the guy fainted and conceded defeat. But the lion's roar was, of course, the teaching of emptiness and selflessness. That's what all that means, you know. So in other words, it isn't like an either-or siddha versus scholastic or scholar. The greatest siddhas were great scholars. The greatest scholastics were great siddhas. And in India, this is, you know, Pandita, Siddha Pandita, or Pandita Siddha is like a thing. Kedrup in Tibetan, they call it Kedrup, Pandita Siddha. And the people who are the great scholars are the ones who really do crazy wisdom, are capable of it, because by doing the great scholarship and then doing the Siddha type practices on top of the great scholarship with an understanding that is unerringly goes along the iron rail of clear reason and common sense, then they get real results. You know, that's the way of getting the real results. If you just do one or the other, without the other, then it takes longer time because you have to do both. Okay? So that's that. Now I would just, in conclusion, I'd like to read, as in starting my Poetry of Enlightenment series, I would like to read some verses from Master Krishna's enlightenment songs, which are called Doha. Kanha Charya is his name, and Kanhapa, the Tibetans call him. He's one of the three great yogis of Chakrasambhara tradition, Luipa, which I think is Matyendranath, Kanhapa or Krishna Charya, and Gandhapa. These are the three greats. And which doesn't include Naropa because he was later than them, but he was a disciple of theirs, actually. Tilopa and he were later, so he was kind of a disciple. So these three, but Kanhapa was one. But here's something for you to chew on. And that is that this Kanhapa was really highly considered one of the great founders of the yogas of Chakrasambhara, the super bliss Buddha machine. Super Bliss Machine Buddha. But he came to a bad end because he had a difficult relationship with females, with Dakini, and not just human ones, but Dakini females, even though he was a great bliss, guy. And it was presaged in his life that his death would eventually be caused by some Dakinis who became annoyed with his arrogance. But also, it was presaged with his teacher called Jalandharipa. His immediate teacher was someone called Jalandharipa. And he was meditating at a apple tree, or maybe mango, I don't know exactly, I forget. Fruit tree, anyway. And he developed such a strong energy connecting to clear light through the Vajra channels that just by gazing, he could pick the fruit. And there was the fruit would then fall off its stem, just by gazing. So then he jumped up and said to Jalandharipa, okay, now I'm going to go out and I'm going to do the wild lifestyle, you know, kind of advanced level of conduct, of a little bit, that's a little bit crazy with some direction. And that guru said, no, you can't do that yet. You shouldn't do that. He says, well, why not? Look, I can knock a fruit off a tree just with my gaze. He said, yes, but can you lift it back on and reattach it to its stem with your gaze? No, who would do that? Well, you shouldn't go off until you can do that. Oh, forget that. You're really being too old-fashioned. I'm going to go out there and really do some crazy stuff. And he took off. And so then this related to him ending up having like not a proper good relationship with the females. There's another great story that connects to which I like, where he was going along and he was going to give an initiation in Demchok or Hivajra or something to the king of Benares, had an appointment. He came to the Ganges with his entourage, and there was a newbie in the entourage, a new disciple named Kusali, and he was carrying all the equipment, like things. And so there was an old crone on the bank of the Ganga where they were going to cross to go on the side, the southern side where the city is. And she looked up at Kanhapa, you know, the guru at the head of the procession, and she said, oh, Guruji, Guruji, great guru, please carry me across the river. I'm so old that I can't walk, I can't wade, I can't swim, and I'm going to go into Benares to die. Please take me across the river. And then the disciples just shooed her out of the way, the senior disciples, and said, come on, lady, this is Kanhapa, the great yogi. He's got to get to, has an appointment with the king of Benares, blah, blah. And they marched right across the surface of the water because they were miracle workers. They were siddhas. And they just walked right across the water. So then Kosali comes along, puffing and puffing, carrying everything, lots of things, bags and boxes and bushels and drums and musical instruments and whatever. And he sees the old lady and he says, well, I can't walk on the water. I have to go back and forth a few times, fording, we're carrying all this stuff. You know, I might as well give that old lady a ride. She doesn't look heavy at all. She's all shriveled, you know, and dried out. So he says, okay, come on, lady, get up on my shoulders. And then he's carrying still some things and he's planning to come back. But of course, he has to wade through the river. So he's wading across the ford. He's a newbie. He doesn't have the powers yet to walk on the water. And then he feels this kind of vibe, like a rocket ship suddenly is around, or a big noise, and like it gets dizzy, and he gets blurred. His perception doesn't know what's going on. And then he lets go of all of his parcels, and then he doesn't know what happened to the lady on his back. But then suddenly she has swiveled around in front of him. She's an exquisite ruby red Vajra Yogini, and she is in embrace, you know, intimate embrace with him, and they are 100 meters in the sky. And he's like, and he's feeling good, kind of, but he's a little freaked out, like, what? And then people are shouting from the far shore of the river, of the ford, saying, hey, that's just Kusali, he's a newbie, the guru's over here. And she said, well, the guru had his chance to show compassion, carry me across the river. But he blew it this time, and this is the third time this kind of thing happened, or something like that. And this guy, he picked me up, so I'm picking him up. See you around. And boom, he went to the Dakini Paradise, and he leaped ahead of the other yogis.
Welcome to the Bob Thurman Podcast. I'm Gary Gock. Robbins and Jeffers lived from 1887 to 1962. He was famous in his early part of his career. He even had a translation of a Greek play performed on Broadway. But he fell out of favor more and more as people became aware of his philosophy, which he called inhumanism rather than humanism. He said, inhumanism is a shifting of emphasis from man to not man, the rejection of human solipsism and recognition of the transhuman magnificence. It offers a reasonable detachment as a rule of conduct instead of love, hate, and envy. But he's been regaining interest in this era of earth consciousness. Vulture by Robbins and Jeffers. I had walked since dawn and laid down to rest on a bare hillside above the ocean. I saw through half-shut eyelids a vulture wheeling high up in heaven, and presently it passed again, but lower and nearer, its orbit narrowing. I understood then that I was under inspection. I lay death still and heard the flight feathers whistle above me and make their circle and come nearer. I could see the naked red head between the great wings bear downward, staring. I said, my dear bird, we are wasting time here. These old bones will still work. They are not for you. But how beautiful he looked, gliding down on those great sails. How beautiful he looked, veering away in the sea light over the precipice. I tell you solemnly that I was sorry to have disappointed him. To be eaten by that beak and become part of him. To share those wings and those eyes. What a sublime end of one's body. What an ensconcement. What a life after death. I'm Gary Gock, and this poetry segment is a part of the Bob Thurman Podcast and is published by Tibet House US, Menla Retreat, and Dewa Spa under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives License. Please feel free to share, redistribute, and post via your favorite online portal.